welcome to the 20th and anti-penultimate episode of the fifth season of the UK podcast. Oh, it's the Ubuntu UK podcast.
Yes, it is.
Tuesday, the 20th of November, and in this episode, we're going to discuss the cult of personality in open source, and we'll interview Kevin Safford about using computers to communicate with his mum. We will, of course, cover the latest news events. Ooh, no events. Bit about Ubuntu. Yeah, we've got some of that. Tomorrow's Technology Day, and we'll go over your feedback. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website or in the IRC channel. I'm Laura, and joining me tonight are Tony.
Hi.
Mark.
Hello.
And Alan.
Hiya.
So, Tony, what have you been up to this past couple of weeks?
I tried Darktable. I wrote a blog post a couple of weeks ago about my photo workflow on Linux following another guy's blog post where he's a professional photographer, but he uses a Mac and has been trying to get over to using Ubuntu. And I was comparing and contrasting with my own, and that was quite popular, but lots of people were suggesting try Darktable. It's really good. So I thought, having tried it last time a couple of years ago, I would try it. So I gave it about an hour. Well, I didn't have a lot of time last night, and I had a blog post to write. So yeah, I was trying it, and it's come a long way, and it's a lot better than it was. It's still not quite what I'm looking for. But
is it a photo management app or an editor or everything?
It's a workflow app. So it's part manager and part editor and tweaker. It's not the full kind of close digital manipulation things like the GIMP does.
Right.
But it's kind of shot well, plus.
How does it compare to Aftershot Pro, which is the one you use normally?
That's what I use, yes. It fits in the same niche. Mm. It's not quite got all the features and things that Aftershot Pro has, but yes, it should fit in that niche.
Is it free software?
It is free, whereas Aftershot Pro isn't, so that's the motivation for trying it. Mm. It's properly free software.
Is it in our repository?
It is, yes.
Oh, right.
I tried the version in 1204, because that's what I'm running on my work computer, and but I suspect there's a newer version, 1210.
Mm.
But, yeah.
Cool.
Mm.
What have you been up to, Mark?
I've been playing games.
And
there's a game that
nothing
I played.
New there.
There's a game I played years ago, back sort of when we first got a PC, called Star Wars Jedi Knight, which was the sequel.
When I first got a PC, the game was Digger.
That's because you're an old man, Tony.
Thank you.
And yeah, I recently discovered that was actually the second game in the series, and there was a prequel to it called Dark Forces,
yes,
which you can now buy off Steam. And if you buy it off Steam, even though it's, you know, a Windows game, you download it and you run it, and it launches in DOSBox.
Excellent. Actually, like,
so it ships with a bundled version of the windowed version of DOSBox and a config file.
Nice.
So you can download it, and then you just download the Linux version of DOSBox and point it to the same config file, and it runs.
That's
so I've been
really
playing awesome. That, which is fun.
Reliving your misspent youth.
Oh, yes.
Alan?
Hello.
What have you been up to?
I bought a game on Steam on Linux.
Ooh.
That's what I did.
Ooh.
Yeah, without wine.
Get you.
So, yeah, the beta of Steam started when we were recording last show, and
yes.
And a load of people have got on board, and I actually bought a game, which was quite a, you know, new thing for me, buying a game in Steam on Linux.
Do you normally steal them?
No, I normally buy them on Windows.
Oh.
or buy the Humble Bundles or something like that, but actually having the Steam client open and actually using it the way it was intended to be, the way everyone's used it in Windows for years and years and years, using it on Linux the same way, and I just went through the normal process of, you know, buying, put your credit card in and all that kind of stuff,
right.
Download the game, press run, and it works. Like,
cool.
No faffing around. No, you know, I've got to get this library or got to edit something. It was just, I bought it and then I played it and it worked.
Brilliant.
And I was happy.
Did you do any good in it?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
Even if you say so yourself.
Yeah, I'm pretty awesome cool. In general, really.
How many Marios did you get? That's a question you ask.
Okay,
isn't it?
Let's not ask.
He
Laura?
Doesn't play many games, does he?
How are you, Laura? What have you been up to?
I'm fine, thank you. I upgraded my laptop to 1210.
Not 1010 that you said on Twitter the other day.
I knew it was one that I pronounced funny. And it's
what do you pronounce funny?
Well, apparently everything, apparently. But I was upgrading to Quantel Quetzal, which I think I called Quick Quack.
Right.
And I thought it was Nutty Nal.
Sorry, you thought it was what?
Okay.
Well, I pronounce them both weirdly, so I got them confused.
Yes, you do. Yeah. Mm. Yes.
And that's why I said on Twitter that I was upgrading to Nitty Narwhal.
Did the upgrade work?
Yeah.
Nothing to report.
No.
It works.
GIMP doesn't
boring.
Let me save
we
as
like
anymore.
It when it breaks.
Yeah, it didn't break. It just...
Is that just because you're using the new version of GIMP where save is now
GIMP.
Called export? Yeah.
And Mendeley has some different buttons.
Mendeley.
The Mendeley. PDF Mendeley. Library.
Ah, okay. Cool.
Ah, yes.
That's about it, really.
Awesome. Cool.
Everything worked.
Linus Torvalds loves KDE. No,
oh,
no.
No, he doesn't.
No, GNOME 3. No,
yeah.
GNOME 2.
No.
Do we care?
He has strong opinions.
Is the question. And it was a question kind of asked by Aaron Saigo, who posted a recent blog post about the cult of personality in free software. And we wanted to discuss that because it seems quite pertinent that to come at this time when people are talking about the various... desktops that they do or don't like, or features that they do or don't like, and whether we should listen to them or take heed of their tales of woe.
And whether it's all failing miserably anyway.
Yes.
So we have reported in this show in the past that Linus has said that he likes a particular desktop environment or doesn't. Mm. His Google Plus mentions and things like that. Mm. But, you know, should we actually care? He is a kernel developer. He is not necessarily a desktop UI engineer and expert.
Well, we should care as much as we care, in my opinion.
So not a lot.
That anyone. Well, me personally, yes. My amount of care is very small. We should care as much as we care about anyone. Yeah, you know, user. Mm. If a user comes to you and says, I can't use this because this is broken, or, you know, I have to use root to add a printer to my SUSE desktop, you know, or whatever it is that he's complaining about this week, then if it's backed up by facts and, you know, reasoned argument, then yeah, why not listen to him as much as you listen to anyone else? The problem is it's not listening to him as much as you listen to anyone else, because he has a huge following and a bazillion people follow him on Google Plus and people hang on every word he says. His opinion seems to matter more than other people.
Okay, so who should we be listening to in an ideal world?
Stephen Fry.
Right. Okay.
A well-known UX expert, Stephen Fry.
Well, actually, it's an interesting example, because after we published the OggCamp video, which he did for us, where he said he uses Ubuntu, there was a story on OMG Ubuntu saying, Stephen Fry says he uses Ubuntu. And quite a bit of the reaction was, oh, wow, that's really cool. And some of the reaction was, yeah, but what do I care what Stephen Fry uses?
And also, his was the most watched video of all of the OggCamp videos, and he wasn't even there.
Yeah.
Now, I like Stephen Fry, and you know, all due respect and things, but it was quite telling that all of the kind of technical talks that were kind of more germane to the business of OggCamp were kind of really overwhelmed by somebody who wasn't there, but is a celebrity, a personality. I'm sure he would hate the label celebrity as much as anybody.
Sure.
But, you know, but we listen to what he says, and
we in general
well, it's the general public, yeah. Judging by the numbers of viewers we have on those videos.
He also says it in a funny way.
It was also
that does help.
I think that video was pimped more than any other. I think it was tweeted and dented and you know, promoted by all of us more than any of the other videos that we made. So that's partly
possibly
why. But I agree with you. I think that when you have, in inverted commas, celebrities, you know, people who are well-known in the public sphere, whether that's well-known in the general public, like, you know, someone like Stephen Fry, or, you know, or people who are known within the kind of insular technical sphere that we reside in, there are always going to be people who not necessarily hang on their every word, but listen to what they say and, you know, take notice of what they say. If that didn't happen, then advertising companies wouldn't use celebrities to sell their products. People listen to what celebrities say and what celebrities endorse. Whether that's a good or bad thing, that is culturally what happens.
You listen to people that you know. I mean, you give people you know more credibility, and I guess celebrities, you feel like you know them, even if you don't actually know them. It's probably just an extension of that.
Yeah, I mean, why would you follow Stephen Fry if you weren't interested in things he had to say? Or, I mean, we don't have to pick on him. Mm. You know, listen to someone like Robert Llewellyn, who talks, yes. who was Crichton in Red Dwarf, who yes. talks a lot about electric vehicles. Yeah, he's got interesting things to say. If when he moans about computing on Google+, he gets a flurry of people telling him to use Ubuntu or Linux in general. He's a Mac user, you know, very
That's
much
the way
like.
To get him across.
Yeah, not really. And he does complain about the fact that people, you know, dogpile him and tell him to use stuff. So it works both ways. You know, they get to hear from, you know, us what we think as well.
Oh, for the good old days when the proles were kept at arm's length.
So I'm not convinced that it's that much of a bad thing, or that it's not something that's endemic in the whole world. You know, you've got TV shows like I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, or, you know, and I'm not saying everyone watches TV, and yeah, but there is this fascination that people have with celebrity and celebrity culture. And I appreciate that a lot of people who work in our sphere of technology, a lot of them don't even have tellies, don't watch mainstream TV, don't even know who some of these celebrities are. So we'll dismiss that argument. But the fact is, there are a huge number of people who are our target audience who do.
Yes.
And so if you put someone up in front of them who says, that desktop sucks, this one's great, they're going to listen.
So do you think Linus saying, I don't use something, I don't use OpenSUSE anymore, I'm now using Unity and I think it's great, would have an effect on the number of people using Unity and the number of people thinking it's great?
I'm not sure that when Linus speaks, everyone goes and downloads an ISO image. I don't think it's as direct as that.
There are a lot of people who say, yeah, I agree. But, yeah, it's... You don't know if they're then going to act on that apparent agreement.
If he went on Google Plus and said, I use Persil Automatic and not, you know, some other brand of washing powder, I'm not instantly going to throw away all my washing powder and buy another one.
Yeah.
Because I don't value his opinion on how to wash my kids' clothes.
You can have your shirts look as smart as Linus's with brand new Daz Auto.
But then again, would people all post saying, yeah, I use Persil as well, it's great, because Linus Torvalds said it? Or would they say, all right, whatever, man, we don't care?
Well, a bit of both, I think. And that's what you get. You know?
Well, that certainly seems to be the case when you look at Mark Shuttleworth, who's one of the biggest cults in the, you know, Ubuntu community.
Right, yes.
He writes a blog post and we'll get lots of, yeah, this is really great, thanks for taking the time to write to us, Mark, and talk to us in the community, us, you know, people down here.
Are you being sarcastic about the sycophants who just jump on there and go, oh, thanks, Mark?
Yes.
Oh, right, okay. I just wanted to be clear.
But you also get the... oh, this is stupid and ridiculous, and why did you do it this way? And whilst you're at it, why don't you fix this, that, and the other?
Yeah, but you also get buttons back people on the left. Articulating yeah. well, you know, in amongst all of those, you get people saying, well, actually,
yes.
you know, where's Windicators, and why did you move the buttons, and actually, you know, you could have told us about that earlier, and, you know, all these other arguments that counter whatever Mark says in his blog post.
Yes, and, you know, Mark has a role as the figurehead of Ubuntu. And, you know, therefore he's supposed to be high profile. He's supposed to have, you know, influence and charisma.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. In an open source context, quite a lot of open source projects are run by a sort of benevolent dictator figure, of which Linus and Mark are two very sort of clear examples. So it's kind of important that they have the sort of influence that they do, where people will say, oh yeah, that's right because he said it, because without that, then they're not actually in charge.
It's not just right because he said it, it's right because they're an expert in that sphere. So, you know, if Linus says you know, we should be removing drivers for things older than, you know, 8 years ago, I know he doesn't think that, I'm just using this as an example, then, you know, people would engage with that conversation and would yeah. take his opinion as something that's worthy. You know, if Mark blogs about bees, then, you know, some people would value that because he happens to keep bees. You know, it's not just about...
Is this inside information?
No, he's posted on his blog.
Oh, right. Okay.
He does have bees. Oh, right. And so it's more about your experience and your sphere of knowledge. So when he does talk about, you know, design things, it's not that, you know, he just made this stuff up, you know, he has actually researched this kind of thing. And similarly, you know, Linus has the experience of using these desktops. So why shouldn't we listen to what they have to say?
Exactly. Yeah, but yeah, and the personality means that you when they come out with that, you sort of trust that. I mean,
it's not
when Mark does
not
a blog post, when Mark does a blog post, he doesn't say, "Oh, here's all the research I've been doing. Go and read it all for yourself, so that you agree with me."
Right.
The sort of expectation is that because he is Mark Shuttleworth, people will trust him that he's done that bit.
Or it's the halo effect, whereby one characteristic of a person that you like, then other characteristics you also like.
Mm.
Sorry.
Technical term.
How does it work, Laura? Can you explain that to us?
If you like one thing about somebody, chances are you'll like other things about them as well.
Oh, you see?
Even things you would normally not like in other people.
Not if it's drastically
unlikable.
Yeah. But, you know, if, say, Stephen Fry says he likes using Mythbuntu, then, you know, people who like him for liking computer stuff, they go, "Oh, right, he must have something there." And I'll
learn
it.
I see. Right. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, you sort of take it on trust.
Do you think, "Oh, if he likes it, then it must be okay"?
I guess so.
Right. Okay. The halo effect. That's another game, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say. I know another halo effect.
But it's not just leaders in our projects. It's not just people like Mark and Linus. There are other people in the Windows world and the Mac world, and I'm thinking deliberately not of leaders, not Bill Gates, not Steve Jobs, people in the communities. You know, you've got
right.
people like, I don't know, Chris Perillo, who's very very well known online. And
who's he?
And yeah, all right.
No, seriously,
no, it's just someone who's well known online.
Right. Oh, right. Oh, well, not for being a part of one of these things. Just he's well
known
guy
for something.
Okay.
I don't know explicitly what,
okay.
but he has a lot of people who follow and hang on every word he says.
Yeah,
and there are other people like Leo Laporte, who has a long history
yes.
of broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
People listen to what he says, and they you know, hang on what he says, and they buy products that he recommends. So it's not just leaders. There are people who are, you know, for want of a better word, celebrities who people follow, and they will listen to those things. And I'm not convinced that it's that bad a thing for us to have some celebrities in our community and for us to listen to them.
No, I agree.
Well, what about the issue of sorry, I'm trying to think of a politically correct way of phrasing this. Of
this is going to be good.
Inherent bias of people kind of being paid effectively to put one point of view forward and using their influence, peddling their influence to
lobbyists.
Yeah, you know, what you hear on Twitter and the wider picture is about celebrities who are paid to tweet pro certain things. But, you know, the whole kind of influence, you get taken out by a lobbyist for dinner, or you get taken up to some headquarters somewhere and given a grand day out, and you come back enthused with this, whatever it might be, this technology. But there isn't the clarity of seeing that. And you can't tell how motivated or what motivates some people who are, quote-unquote, celebrities or, you know, personalities in the community.
I guess it just depends how long they go on about it for. can they sustain that enthusiasm?
That contract ran out.
Yeah, exactly.
I shall no longer be talking about Daz.
But is that sort of thing going to affect open source and free software communities? What sort of technologies might people be? I mean, you're not going to, you know, take someone out for lunch to convince them that, I don't know, that file system that Samsung just made is amazing.
No, but if companies have partnerships, like, you know, Red Hat have a partnership with some storage company, or, you know, the people who work for Red Hat might be inclined to not blog negatively about that storage
mm-hmm.
company. And the
yeah.
same, I'm not saying specifically Red Hat, just, you know, the same thing could happen to Canonical employees, encouraged not to negatively post about, you know, HP or whatever deal is currently on the cards. You know, it's...
Oh, I've noticed quite a positive tone in your blog posts about HP.
I have never blogged about
it. I think
micro server, hang on.
Backpedal.
I like that product.
That was
buy one.
Months ago. Right, okay. So what are our conclusions around cults of personality?
I don't think they're the worst thing in the world.
I think it's inevitable. It's part of our culture. And I think there's a typical reaction from people who aren't or don't like that part of our culture and are kind of sideways from that culture. And that's, you know, fair enough. They can have their opinion, but I don't think it's all bad.
Some of it's just fun. It's fun to find out what they say and see what other people say. Yeah.
Genuinely interested to know what desktop Linus uses.
Yeah.
That's interesting piece of information. And when he talks about the fact that his daughter couldn't or wife couldn't add a printer because she didn't have root access. I learned something there. I didn't realize that's how they'd configured their desktop. And that's something, if anyone ever said we should configure our desktop to do that, I would say no. And here's why.
And so, it's always nice to know that people have the same problems that you have.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. You know, we're learning from other people's mistakes and missteps. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing at all. What do you think?
Well, if you've got any thoughts and opinions on the cult of personality, cult of celebrity, particularly in the computing and open source world, you can send them in to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
And now it's time for the news. Oracle has publicly released a Git repository called Redpatch, containing each change Red Hat makes to the Linux kernel as an individual commit. Red Hat recently changed from publishing changes individually to making them available as one large patch, making it harder for competitors such as Oracle to make use of individual changes.
So they've kind of reverse engineered Red Hat's patch.
It's kind of cheeky and kind of flicking the V's at Red Hat, I think.
Yeah.
But equally, it's also practical.
Yeah, it's something they've done because it's useful to them internally, because they don't need all of the patches for what they're using them for.
Right.
But then also they can say, look at what we've released to get one over on them.
Exciting.
An Indiegogo crowdsourcing campaign has been launched for PengPod. Is that how we pronounce that?
PengPod.
A new range of dual booting tablets running Android and OpenSUSE-based Linux distribution with Plasma Active. Offering a 7-inch device for $120, the project is currently halfway to its $49,000 funding goal in just under 2 weeks to go.
So how does that compare with the Nexus 7 price, $120?
It's cheaper.
Yeah, it's cheaper.
But the screen is fairly low resolution. Compared to the Nexus 7.
Yeah. Okay, well, halfway to $50,000.
Yeah,
we'll
have to keep an eye on that one.
Compared to some other projects, it's a fairly low goal because I think the guy's basically just getting some fairly commodity hardware and shipping it, so he just needs basically money to buy stock from what I gather.
It's an interesting prospect, and I kind of wonder whether they have the enthusiasm, because the way they describe it is a true Linux tablet and mini PC, and then halfway down it says, "Yeah, we ship it with Android and a stick that's got Ubuntu on it."
You can pay like a few dollars extra to have it pre-flashed with Linux.
Well, that just sucks. Surely the whole point of the project is we're making a one true Linux tablet, and then you have to pay more to get the one true Linux bit. That's taking the mick.
Yep. Freedom comes at a price, my friend. The GNOME project has announced that it will be dropping the GNOME 2-like fallback mode from GNOME 3.8, stating that the project is unable to maintain the fallback option at a reasonable quality.
Oh, dear.
Lots of people were commenting on this article, saying we liked GNOME 2.8 fallback mode thing.
Yeah, it's very similar to the old two-panel, GNOME 2 desktop of yore. From the past.
Some people were complaining that although there were people who were trying to maintain it but weren't able to get their patches in and things, maybe that's part of the problem.
I think there's already a fork, isn't there, of that thing?
Is it?
Isn't one of the ones that Linux one of the ones that Linux Mint ships with? There's Cinnamon and Mate. I think you'll find it is. Yeah, really.
Cinnamon.
Yeah.
All right. Get a move on, otherwise it might be latte.
Oh, okay.
VLC developer Jean-Baptiste Kempf has completed the long process of relicensing the VLC media player under the GNU Lesser General Public License. The process involved contacting each contributor for consent to relicense their work, and in some cases removing or rewriting code that couldn't be relicensed.
That's a massive amount of work.
Yeah.
Did he get them to sign a general agreement?
Well, yeah, this is the thing. A lot of projects, particularly like projects in the Apache Foundation, when you contribute to them, you don't just license them your code, you give them your code.
PHP had to deal with this, didn't they?
I'm not sure how it works. But yeah, so rather than just them keeping their copyright and licensing it to them under a license like they've done with VLC, it means that the Apache Foundation have control, so they don't have to, if for some reason they decided to like update the Apache license, they wouldn't then have to go to every contributor who ever contributed to each of their projects and say, is this all right? Like this guy just had to do.
Doesn't this open the door for VLC to go into stores, app stores, where the GPL is more difficult to use, like the Apple App Store?
I guess this was part of the rationale behind it. I didn't really read all of that, but yeah, I'm not sure exactly how.
Because under LGPL, you could put it in the App Store and it would. The license would be compatible with the store restrictions.
Ah, would it?
Yeah.
Okay, then. Cool. That could be why. Mm. Google has launched Ingress, a mobile game based around real-world locations. The game is currently in closed beta, but invites can be requested from ingress.com. Who's got one?
Yes!
Of course you have.
Unsurprisingly, despite not having an Android phone.
I think previous Ubuntu UK podcast presenter Simon has
yes,
Ingress thing.
He has it as well. He's been running around like a lunatic.
So what do you do?
You go outdoors, which is a big stumbling block. Yeah,
where's that?
Yeah,
it's raining today.
It's the big blue room. You go out there and you
the big light.
You find portals and you take over those portals. You hack the portals and you hack the Gibson or something. And
I'm sorry.
Get arrested for that.
And there's two factions and you fight against each other. And but it's an augmented reality thing. So when you walk outside and you go it.
I was going to say, this is a different world than the one I've been in.
You go out there and there's like, it's very popular in built-up areas where there's like...
it's based around like artworks and sculptures and things like that.
So you go to the monument and you hold the phone up and you hack the thing virtually on your phone.
Basically London.
And other major cities as well. Yeah. And there's some in Southampton as well.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, we've got lots of hackers there, so
yes.
That would make sense.
Yes.
So what do you hack?
Well, it's sort of, there's two teams competing against each other for control of each portal.
And there are these portals placed where there are artworks. So you have to physically go to the, and be in the proximity of the artwork or the whatever it is.
It's not just reading a QR code or something.
No, you have to physically go there. It detects your proximity and then you can hack it when you're within 60 meters or something of it. And once you've done that, you join them up and, you know.
Get into fights with other people.
Yes, all that kind of good stuff. It's interesting. And it...
Sounds quite good financially.
Yeah, and as I said, it's outdoors, which is, you know, good.
Tchaikovsky calls it QR codes +++.
Not QR codes. Finally, Google has added a clause to the Android SDK license agreement requiring that developers agree not to take actions that may cause or result in fragmentation of Android, including creating an alternative SDK derived from the official one. Is this a bit evil?
Sounds a little bit evil.
Don't use our product to make a competing
product.
Yeah. Well, this was after there was a recent story we talked about where another company had taken a fork of Android.
Yeah, right.
And you could run Android apps on it, but it wasn't Android.
Right.
And they didn't like that.
No.
So, it was Asus, wasn't it?
So kind of doing the open source thing.
They cease and desisted them.
Amazon basically do the same thing, don't they?
With...
Kindle Fire.
I don't think so. I think that is Android.
That
with
is
skin
Android,
on top,
is it?
With a thing on top, so
and
you can't get to the
lockdown.
Underneath guts.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't know if it was that or an actual fork.
It's actually surprisingly common in SDKs. There are other SDKs out there where you know, non-free ones, where you can't use the SDK to create a competing product for the SDK.
Interesting.
Well, that's the end of the news.
Hello, and welcome to Tomorrow's Technology Today. I'm Douglas Austin Cambridge. Good day to all our listeners, wherever you are, around the British Empire. So, my doyen of the domestic, by which I mean my delightful co-host, Miss Deirdre Morris Oxford, what sort of technology can we expect tomorrow? Or possibly the day before that?
We are speaking today about the dire possibility of war, Douglas. Major world powers are considering harnessing the explosive power of the atom in a process called nuclear fission.
The only fission I know about is trout fishing, Deirdre. A splendid lakes in Scotland.
Let's speak to the head of British Atomic Research, Professor Hubert Mugtree. Good day, Professor.
Good day, Deirdre.
Just what are you researching?
By enclosing fissionable heavy elements in a combustible sphere to produce a chain reaction, we are attempting to construct a submolecular implosive explosive device.
You mean an atomic bomb?
That's a gross oversimplification. Yes.
And how is it progressing?
If all goes well, the British Empire will possess the first weapon capable of flattening an area the size of the city of Birmingham.
And if it doesn't go well?
We shall probably flatten the city of Birmingham.
No harm done, then.
Not now, Douglas. So, Professor, when do you expect to build this atomic bomb?
As soon as we've mined and enriched enough of the rare isotope, uranium-235.
Is that up, Uranus?
Not now, Douglas.
But according to our calculations, we need about 2 tons, so in approximately 150 years.
Well, that's a relief. For a moment, I thought we were facing Armageddon. We can all rest easy, knowing that only another conventional world war with Germany poses any threat to the Empire. And Herr Hitler will never contemplate that. So breathe a sigh of relief, Birmingham. You're safe for now.
Professor, are you sure you need 2 tons of uranium?
The German figures have proved it. Absolutely. No question. Possibly. Would you care to come over for a spot of tiffin, my dear? It seems I've got about 150 years to wait for my experiment to finish.
Really, Professor? What sort of physicist do you take me for?
That's all from Tomorrow's Technology Today. A toodle-pip and God save the King.
Talking to Kevin Safford, who's been making a computer for his mum, who lives about 200 miles away?
It's about 100.
100 miles. So it's not an easy drop-in.
It certainly isn't.
So do you want to explain briefly what the computer is and why you decided to make it?
Yeah, I went for a small ARM-based plug computer, which is sort of known as a dream plug, I think, on account of the screen that comes with it. So it's a computer that's literally sort of the size of my hand, including the power supply unit, and a 10-inch USB touchscreen to go with it. I wanted that sort of setup because I wanted to run something Linux-based for administering remotely. And I wanted something that wouldn't be too obtrusive at my mum's. I didn't want a hulking great desktop or a laptop that would put her off. So this matches the bill quite nicely.
So how much does she actually interact with the tablet itself?
She doesn't. I mean, that was one of the things that I probably should have thought through a bit better at the start. I asked on the local lug for advice on touchscreen support with Linux, and found that there wasn't much unless you went for a USB solution. At the time, I thought that this was pretty critical, but it turns out not to be so, because my mum doesn't really drive the thing at all. I drive it, so I could have got away with using something more conventional.
What were the initial requirements? Was it your mum came to you and said, what's this new fangled computery internet thing? Or was it something? What prompted you to do this?
Yeah, no, good question. My mum's got Alzheimer's, so she's lost quite a few abilities to do day-to-day tasks. She struggles, for example, to make a phone call now. I have to tell her how to switch the TV on and off. And I sort of semi-jokingly thought about getting a webcam fitted up for some time so that I could keep an eye on her. It was actually the Alzheimer's specialist that gave me the idea for doing a webcam plus. So I floated the idea to my mum. I put it forward to her, explained what I wanted to do. And she was very supportive. She was very keen on it.
So it was mainly for a peace of mind for you rather than a utility for her?
No, that was the initial thing. And it's interesting, sort of, I've done a bit of Googling on it, and that seems to be the starting point for a lot of people, that, yes, you can see the person that you're caring for. But I've taken it a lot further than that, and I actually think that the peace of mind for me is a nice bonus. The main good points about this, so that it enhances the quality of life of my mum.
Right. And what does she actually, I'm imagining not a webcam in the corner of the room just, for want of a better word, spying on her. What does she actually do on a daily basis with it?
Okay. Well, she sometimes, the webcam thing, we use video chat, so I'll sort of VNC in to the thing and call her initially from my end so the bell rings at her end to alert her to the fact that there's an incoming call, and she'll come and sit down in front of it. And then I go through to her computer and ring myself and answer it, and then we just talk, and all Mum needs to do is to sit there, look at me, which is no doubt really pleasurable for her. Then we have a chat, and the chats have been a lot richer than they were just audio. I think having that visual dimension adds something to it, so we've got that side of it. I've done some other things as well, using a combination of sort of Perl scripts and cron jobs. So, for example, she gets a message that comes up every day, first of all to tell her what day it is, and then to tell her what she's got on for that day. It's done through an HTML page, and it's in a nice big font so that she can see the thing. The web page is constructed on the fly from a combination of sort of static information, because Tuesdays, for example, she tends to do the same thing every Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And a structured text file that'll let me put in one-offs for her. So I think that's useful for her. It reassures her as to what she's got to do. One of the things that she would say quite a lot was, "I'm confused. I don't know what I've got to do." So I think that has definitely helped.
So a lot of people would think, a computer for my mum. I mean, traditionally, my mum has never had a computer, and now she has one, and she uses it for what you would traditionally use a computer for, Facebook and email and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I guess your mum's use case, what with her condition, she doesn't need email, or do you not have any other applications, for want of a better word, on there? It's mainly a communication device for you.
You pretty much get email for given. When you sign up with an ISP, so she's got a Virgin Media email account. Mm-hmm. She's got a Gmail email account, because I thought that Google Talk, or whatever they're now calling it, was going to be an option for us to do. But that wouldn't play nicely with the ARM processor. So she's got at least a couple of email accounts that she's blissfully unaware of. I get redirected to me in the event that there's anything she needs to look at.
So the issue with not being able to use Google Hangouts and other proprietary plugins is because you've made the selection of having a low cost, low power ARM device.
Yeah, basically, I think it's running Debian Squeeze, and the browser on it is, I think, a back-level Mozilla. And I just couldn't install the plug-in to get the thing working.
I don't think it's available for ARM. Well, we've had similar issues on ARM devices as well.
Well, I've been able to work around it. I've got Ekiga up and running at both ends, and that seems to work okay, so I was good for that. And it's been an interesting learning experience, actually, for me. It's really made me appreciate the benefits of the Libre bit of a floss of free Libre open source, as opposed to the free and beer bit. Some of the commercial software makers, such as Dropbox, I toyed with the idea of doing that, and I there was another one that won't run on ARM out of the box, but they do at least make the source available, so if I decide I want to bite the bullet, I could compile it and run that on MUMS.
So So you've truly been bitten by the proprietary stuff not working on ARM, but you're using Akiga as the soft phone.
Yeah, that's right.
And is there any particular webcam you're using, any other hardware you're using with her ARM device to...
What did I do? I got an all-in-one for about 16 quid from some very nice people in Singapore. A webcam, mic and speaker. It's only a mono speaker, but it's more than adequate for what my mum wants. One of the other things that I do on it is to play music for her. Twice a day, so I've stuck some OGs and MP3s and so on her drive, and I've got a couple of scripts that play these or play a selection for her twice a day.
What's the rationale for that? Is it to get her in tune with what time of day it is, or to?
It's more sort of quality of life, really, something out of the ordinary. I mean, left to her own devices, she'll sit and watch Sky News 24 hours a day, which is so depressing. It's really
yeah.
You know, it's on half an hour loop, and you've got the thing going continuously. So it's an attempt to get out of that. So again, that was an interesting thing because of the limited spec of the computer that I've got. I had to do a bit of digging for something that would play nicely without taking up a lot of system resources, and I came up with Mach-P to do it, which is a text-based thing. Nothing flash, no skins or anything like that, but it does the job. It works absolutely brilliantly.
So if somebody else wanted to do this, how easy do you think it would be, or is your particular setup so customised to you that you'd have to start from scratch?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I wouldn't start from where I did. I mean,
the traditional answer, yes.
Yeah. I'd start, depending on the level of expertise time and that available to people. I think the concepts behind it are not difficult. I'm actually making available the scripts that I've done at work, and I will hopefully sort of publish them outside of that. I think the big thing, if it were going to take off, and I hate to say this on an Ubuntu... it would need, shall we say, making available for different platforms and other systems.
Mm. Right.
Let's leave it there.
I can see the... What was the decision about choosing the thin ARM device? Was it just cost or power or what? Why? Because that seems to have driven some of your decisions.
It has indeed, yeah. I got it a bit backwards, I think, on that. It was, like I said, I think the primary reason was the size of the thing, that I wanted something that would fit in my mum's in my mum's living room, because it's important that it be somewhere where she is for most of the time. I don't want it tucked away, otherwise she'd never see these notices that I'm putting up that say...
Right. Yes, that makes sense.
So-and-so. So, and given mum's age group, there's a lot of ornaments and things in as well. So it's a sort of balance in that.
So there's maybe a gap in the market for something that looks like an ornament, but is actually
cunningly disguised.
I mixed up with Virgin as the ISP, and I had sort of similar decisions about where to put the modem.
Yeah.
And she really liked the look of the super hub.
It's quite cool.
Yeah.
The nice blue light.
Yeah, that's pretty much what she said.
How do you go about remotely connecting in? And is it just a case of, you know, because you're an expert, you can just use SSH and, you know, you're all nice and secure? How do you deal with those kind of aspects?
Don't call me an expert, no. I SSH in, and most of the time I'll export the display And then if I want to, I don't know, do something that needs an X program, I can run it without the full overhead of running the desktop.
Right.
I restrict the VNC really to when I want to sort of interact with my mum over the phone. It's had an interesting side effect for the way that I personally use Linux, because I come from MS-DOS originally, then through various shades of Windows, and when I went on to Ubuntu Hardy, I tended to use the GUI way of doing things. With connecting remotely, I'm much more at ease with using the command line now, so for setting up cron jobs and that, I've got no problems sort of doing a cron tab minus E to get it done. But I feel really good about that.
Yeah.
So is there, now that you've got this set up as it is there something more that you'd like to do with it for the future?
So I've got a couple of other bits done on it. So what I mentioned, the music, the notices. I run some photos for us, so it's slideshow of photos once a day. Again, a low overhead thing, FEH, which lets me put captions on them, so mum can look at them and see what they are, because she's forgotten quite a lot. You know, she'll see a picture of a house where she grew up as a child and not remember where it is. So it's really good if she can see these things. And I grab podcasts for her. I'll probably stick this one. I have great fun, again, because of the preponderance of Sky News, I try to get the carers to put the TV onto something else. Mm. But I didn't want her to lose the news altogether, so I grab a podcast from the BBC that's a compilation of world and UK news during the weekdays, and I've stitched onto the front of that the chimes of Big Ben, so it's a separate
wow.
And it goes bong, 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 and then starts playing the news to us.
Brilliant. Has there been, have you had conversations, I appreciate that, you know, this might be a difficult question to answer, but have you had conversations about how this has improved, or is there any measurable way that you can say your mum's life is better for having these things done for her?
Not measurable, I wouldn't think. Although all the sort of anecdotal evidence and remarks by neighbours and my observations have helped.
Mm.
And mum herself tells me that that she enjoys it, that she likes it.
Excellent.
Are you looking for help in making it, developing it further?
So, yes, I am. I'm working on that at work. I want very much to get this out and sort of make it known that this can be done.
Mm.
It surprised me, actually, because nothing in it is revolutionary or particularly new. It just seems to me that people haven't had the idea of doing this.
It's putting it all together, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. And what would be really nice is to get someone that's a lot brighter than I am working on something that would cover the bulk of the user base and that would let them just plug something in and go.
So port it to Windows or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Where would somebody contact you if they wanted to find out more?
Yeah, I've got a Twitter account at the moment. I think it's Kev Saff is my Twitter ID, so that's probably the best one.
Okay.
You can email me at kevin.safford@gmail.com.
Okay, we'll put we probably won't put a link to your email.
We'll put a link to the Twitter account in the show notes.
We'll put a link to your Twitter and they can get hold of you that way.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's great. Thank you very much.
I'm so grateful for the chance to tell people about this.
Great, thank
you. It's been lovely to hear about it. Thank you, Kevin.
Cheers, then.
Bye.
it's time for the bit about Ubuntu.
Yes.
Smooth.
And the first bit about Ubuntu, a stable release upgrade is being worked on to backport UEFI secure boot support to 12.04, allowing the latest LTS release to continue to work on new Windows 8 certified machines. This is good, isn't it?
It is.
As people will be able to buy them now.
Yeah. And because 12.04 came out before all the secure boot stuff was finalised, the ISO images that are out there at the moment don't work with secure boot machines, or may not work with secure boot certified machines.
Or you need to at least poke around in the BIOS to get them to work.
Possibly, yeah. I've never played with one, so I don't know.
No, but I've not seen one either.
At the beginning of next year, there is a new respin, a new point release of 12.04.2. And from that point onwards, 12.04 will be supporting those kinds of pieces of hardware.
It's weird to think there are computers that won't have a BIOS. I mean, the BIOS has been around longer than any operating system.
There are a lot of computers from one manufacturer that don't have a BIOS.
Yes, yes. Okay.
And haven't had for a very long time.
So what do you have if you don't have a BIOS?
We have UEFI.
But what's that if it's not a BIOS?
Okay.
Touché.
Yeah, well, it's a firmware, it's not like the traditional BIOS where you press Del during setup and get into a funky screen for...
I don't think I've ever pressed Del.
Or F1 or a function key. Oh, man. Yeah.
If you've never changed your boot sequence, you haven't lived.
Mm.
Yes.
Have you never
I've never pressed Del.
Well, A button.
F2. Then.
It's different on different computers.
I know it is.
Oh, okay. I'll ignore you, troll.
Troll. Ignore the haters.
Yeah.
Rick Spencer, director of Ubuntu Engineering, has blogged about the road to the next LTS release, which is going to be 14.04.
Yes.
Following on from the UDS at somewhere in
Copenhagen.
Yes. Cold. With expensive beer.
Cold and expensive, yes.
So he's been writing about the things that are going to be coming along for 14.04 and what they need to do to get there, more crucially. Quite a range of things. The vision is that it's going to be robust, fresh, easy to make, and ubiquitous.
Yeah, there's a little bit of detail. It's quite high level, but there's a little bit of detail in there about things like... doing phased updates. The use of something called autopilot, which we use.
You spoke about that old cam, didn't you?
Internally. Yeah, briefly I did. Yeah, autopilot,
yes.
Which I've been using today. We use autopilot to do automated GUI testing. And that's all rather good. And
whole kind of build infrastructure around the way packages are. We build and tested before they even get to testing.
Well, we already tested them anyway, but there's a lot more automation in it now, so that a developer can, push their change into Launchpad, and then automatically a job picks that up, packages it up, and then does a whole load of testing on it.
Mm.
And some of that will be tested on real hardware, so it'll actually boot a machine, start a new version of Unity or whatever it is that the developer has changed, and automate a whole load of tests, and only if a certain percentage of them pass will it actually come through into the distribution.
Brill.
Yeah, it's really cool. There's loads of other stuff in Rick's blog post as well, like sandboxing applications, application isolation, stuff like that with AppArmor security team are working on. And that's quite cool.
And a picture of Sam and Al from Quantum Leap.
Yes.
Which is quite cool.
Yes. I'm not quite sure why that's there. But never mind.
Version 2.0 of the Ubuntu Code of Conduct has been released.
Does this mean we have to upgrade?
No, it's assumed you will.
Oh, is there a clause saying you agree to
this? You agree to this.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we put loads of evil stuff in there, and you've agreed to that, so you're bound by that now.
I don't think I've ever signed it.
You don't have to go around and ask everybody individually.
No. Some changes were made and merging numerous documents together. Some work that Laura Tchaikovsky's been doing on the community council.
So this means there's only one code of conduct, roles.
We used to have like a code of conduct and a leadership code of conduct. It's just one document. And there were some things that people found objectionable in that, and we took those out and reworded large chunks of it. It's if you look at the diff between the old one and the new one, it's just basically the whole document's been rewritten. So it's good.
Cool.
Excellent. So will people have to re-sign that when they renew their Ubuntu membership?
I'm not sure, actually. I don't know. You'd have to ask Laura.
Okay. She's in her IRC channel. I'm sure she'll be frantically typing now.
Give her the 10-second delay.
While she's typing that, I will talk about Ubuntu Community Appreciation Day, which is happening. When's it happening?
Yay! Today. That means people appreciate us.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Appreciate your local Ubuntu Community podcasters.
Oh. Yay!
That's us.
Yes.
Right. Laura says we don't need to resign.
Resign!
Oh, I see. Right. there we go. Yes, it's Ubuntu Appreciation Day, and some people are being appreciated on the internet for it.
Okay. And finally, in Not About Ubuntu, the GNOME project is seeking a new community manager to help the project relate to its user base and to avoid too much controversy around decisions that are made.
Like dropping fallback mode?
Yes.
So, yes. GNOME 3.8, is that basically a lot like Unity, or is it completely different?
Well, GNOME 3.8 includes GNOME Shell, which is the desktop, and loads of other components underneath that support that, like GTK and other stuff.
Okay, if I were a dumb user and I looked at a 3.8 laptop screen...
A machine that was running GNOME 3.8, right?
Would that look like Unity?
A bit.
Yeah,
a bit. It would have a thing across the top and buttons down the side.
Okay.
And it would have a thing when you launched it with all the icons, kind of like the dash.
Yeah.
But not quite. So
there are similar, but quite
similar.
There are some similarities. Where they differ is...
Well,
there are differences.
There's more of a pluggable architecture with GNOME Shell. You can write like little JavaScript plugins for it to add features and stuff like that.
Just curious because I've never seen it.
One thing I've just noticed on this job description here for the GNOME community manager says, must be good at shutting stable doors once the stables are empty. I don't know quite what that means.
Excellent.
It is time for your feedback, and first out of the bag this week, Andrew Turner emailed us.
Someone at the Oxford English Dictionary listens to your podcast or is an Ubuntu... listen to your podcast or is an Ubuntu user, or both. On Saturday, the Oxford English Dictionary website's word for the day was skunkworks. Surely no coincidence.
Absolutely. Our reach is far and wide.
Yes. This is after we talked about the Mark Shuttleworth Skunkworks project a couple of episodes ago, I think.
Yes, it was, which is still ongoing, and invitations have been sent out, and there's now, on the wiki, there's a document for, it's kind of a code of conduct. It's like a few bullet points of how...
Merge it.
of how we would... Well, it's very different because it's about, you know, keeping a few things...
This is the not an NDA.
Behind, yeah, the not an NDA, but it's a bit like one in that we're asking you nicely, you know, please don't reveal what's behind the curtain until the big reveal.
Have we got a collective noun for these people yet? Are they skunks?
I think skunks. They're skunks. Right, yeah, okay. I think they're skunks. Interestingly, I didn't realise where the skunkworks derived from.
Oh.
And apparently it is a trademarked term.
Oh.
The term skunkworks.
Really?
It's is it Lockheed, I think, in the States? They set up a thing called Skunkworks where they worked on these kind of projects internally. And it's existed for years.
Originally, I think it's like there was a bit of certain works that went on in some factories where people tended not to go and visit because the work, it's something to do with certain electronic components where the stuff they were working with smelt really bad, which is why it's called a skunk works.
Thanks, Wikipedia.
Yes.
Lockheed appropriated the term for sort of secretish projects where people didn't go and interfere.
Where people smell. Oh. How appropriate.
Indeed.
Paul Dart tweeted to ask,
how many of the creatures in release names are on the vulnerable or critical threat of extinction list? Just something I was thinking.
There was a thing about Lucid Lynx, wasn't there, when they released that?
Yes, and giving money to a Lynx charity.
Yes.
And narwhals.
I worry more about the jackrabbit.
Yes.
You don't see many jackalopes around.
No, you don't. No.
Yes.
Yeah. If you've seen a jackalope, why not?
Send us a picture. Super Engineer mentioned in our IRC channel,
John O'Bacon tweeted, it is amazing to watch the journey of a fart illustrated by your baby's face. Are there any similarities to the release cycle?
No comment.
Absolutely. It does give us opportunity to congratulate Jono on his new baby.
Yes.
And Erica, of course.
Yes, Monsignor John Edward Bacon or something, isn't it? No?
That's
Jedward.
Jack Taylor, I think.
Jack, it's just so you can give him a ball.
That's very good.
The theme of Lug Radio is called Jack's Playing Ball.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow. You're a massive Lug Radio fangirl, aren't you?
No. I'm just quick off the mark.
Okay.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, where you can find our voicemail numbers and Twitter feed, Facebook and Google Plus pages, and our IRC channel. So plenty of ways to get in touch. There's just no excuse. Let us know what you think of the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community that makes it. Join us on Tuesday, the 4th of December. Yikes. And for our next live broadcast, the penultimate episode of the season.
We're going to have some time off again, are we?
We're going to have Christmas.
Yeah. I am. I don't know about the rest of you.
We're not broadcasting over Christmas, live from your lounge.
On Christmas Day.
On Christmas Day.
Maybe over dinner.
We should put out a special Christmas Day
episode. Tony's speech. The Queen's speech.
I think I might resent the implications of that.
Are we doing something special for Christmas on the show?
I think we are.
Yes, it's
all
keep
well listening planned. To find out more.
Yes.
What we think of it.
Yeah, so two more episodes left, and then that'll be it for the year, and then we'll think about going back.
And then so maybe we'll sell all the equipment and never do this again.
You don't need to email us 2 weeks after Christmas asking where the show is. We're warning you now.
Yes. And thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.